Investment by Irish Water in infrastructure this year is set to be significantly lower than the average annual spend by central government and local authorities on water services over the previous 10 years. Documents obtained by RTE News under Freedom of Information show the company's capital spend on infrastructure up to November this year was €300 million. The average annual spend between 2004 and 2013 was €430 million. Coleman O'Sullivan reports.
One thing that all sides of the debate on water charges can agree is that in the past there has not been enough investment in water infrastructure. This has meant water not fit to drink in some counties, barely enough water in Dublin, and no sewage treatment in many towns. But the last 2 years has seen the lowest level of investment in water services since 1998. Investment peaked at €512 million in 2009, but the government spent just €275 million in 2013 as it prepared to hand over the system to Irish Water. In the first 11 months of this year, Irish Water spent just under €300 million. It is committed to investing €1.77 billion over the 3 years 2014, 15 and 16. On leaks, the company has predicted that installing water meters will help it to pinpoint where water is being lost. But despite installing more than 500,000 meters, it is on course to repair around the same number of leaks as last year, just over 26,000. The company says it has made significant progress identifying and fixing some major leaks, and its capital spend will be €340 million by the end of this year.
Political talks among Northern Ireland's parties will resume in Belfast this morning. The Minister for Foreign Affairs, Charlie Flanagan, who is co-chairing the negotiations with the Northern Ireland Secretary of State, Theresa Villiers, said significant progress was made last week and he is hopeful the work can now be completed. Last night, Ms. Villiers said it was make your mind up time for the North's political leaders. Our Northern editor, Tommy Gorman.
For the 10th week in a row, Charlie Flanagan from the Midlands and Sean Sherlock from Cork are travelling north. A Fine Gael Minister for Foreign Affairs and a Labour Minister of State will seek to broker an agreement among Stormont's five main parties, Sinn Féin included. Exactly a year ago, two seasoned US diplomats, Richard Haass and Megan O'Sullivan, failed in their efforts. In the 12 months since, the resultant stalemate has damaged Northern Ireland politics, bickering along orange-green lines, ministers challenging the decisions of colleagues in the courts, stories about politicians' expenses gaining more attention than the falling unemployment statistics. Some of the issues under negotiation, such as the structures required to fairly address Northern Ireland's troubled past, are very challenging. But in a setting where the default position is to disagree, there will be one final push to end the year with a deal.
The number of Irish graduates finding work abroad has risen, according to new data from the Higher Education Authority. An analysis of last year's college leavers has found that 9 months later, 12% of honours degree holders were working abroad, compared to 10% the previous year. Our education correspondent Emma O'Kelly.
The HEA figures show that 9 months after leaving college, just over half of all those who graduated with honours degrees in 2013 had found employment. 39% here in Ireland, that's lower than the previous year, and 12% abroad, higher than before. Female honours degree graduates were more likely to have found jobs by then compared to their male counterparts, but their salaries were lower. Overall, though, those salaries appear slightly higher than the starting salaries of a year earlier. Those with degrees in computer science were most likely to be working 9 months on, 77%. This is followed by education at 76%. But the proportion of honours education degree graduates finding work here fell by almost a fifth this year to 68%, most of them in temporary part-time work, while 10% more than the previous year, 16%, were working overseas.
Computer hackers have published sensitive technical documents from South Korea's nuclear power industry. They've also threatened to damage some plants if they're not shut down by Christmas. The threat is being taken seriously by the South Korean government, which insists that the central operating systems of reactors have not been hacked into. Some independent experts have expressed concern that it's very difficult to establish if the perpetrators are individuals or a government like North Korea. An increasing number of shops are surcharging purchasers of pay-as-you-go credit for energy meters, according to research by the Money Advice and Budgeting Service. MABS, which first highlighted the practice in August, has called it a shameful rip-off of the most financially vulnerable customers. On this programme, MABS spokesman Michael Cullity expressed concern that people are being overcharged for a basic service.
The highest charge was in County Mayo, where a customer was charged €1 to top up a 10 euro top up, which is crazy. But in the Greater Dublin area, it varies between 20 cent and 50 cent on top of for a top up. You know, the other thing to remember is that a lot of these consumers are already paying a portion of their top up to arrears. They could be paying 25% to 30% on top.
Tributes have been paid to the British actress Billie Whitelaw, who has died in London at the age of 82. Billie Whitelaw was best known for her work with the playwright Samuel Beckett, who described her as the perfect actress. And now the time is 7 minutes past eight.
The case of the pregnant woman at the centre of the current High Court proceedings provides the lead story in today's Irish Times. We're told that neurosurgeons who treated the woman recommended that her life support be switched off after determining that she was clinically dead, but that lawyers for the HSE became involved when another member of the medical team expressed concern about possible legal issues. The case is before the High Court tomorrow, when the woman's father is expected to ask for her to be made a ward of court. The father of the woman's unborn child is also understood to be in favour of switching off her life support, although he is not a party to tomorrow's proceedings. The death of the 15-year-old boy who died when the car in which he was travelling hit a tree in Clondalkin in Dublin provides the lead story in today's Irish Daily Star, Irish Daily Mirror and Herald. The Irish Independent leads this morning with the line that Sean Quinn is to be employed as an advisor to his former company by its new owners. 1,100 people on brink of losing homes, that's the lead headline in the Irish Examiner. The Irish Sun leads today with a story about a 46-year-old Pakistani national who says that she was trafficked into Ireland and treated as a slave for 2 years by two Irish-based Pakistani doctors. Sultana Anwar, who was forced to work 18 hours a day minding the couple's three children in their home in Leinster and also cleaning their rental properties, managed to escape when a neighbour put her in contact with the Migrant Rights Centre, who have since called on the Gardaí to review the case. Anti-booze pill for alcoholics, that's the lead headline in today's Irish Daily Mail, which reports that a drug which curbs the craving for alcohol experienced by heavy drinkers has been approved for use by the HSE. Elsewhere on the front pages, both the Times and Independent report that US billionaire John Malone, who's behind UPC-owned Liberty Global, has bought Sir Anthony O'Reilly's Castle Martin estate for close to €28 million. Both papers also carry front page stories on that Higher Education Authority report on the number of graduates emigrating. Both papers use the term brain drain, and the Independent devotes its lead editorial to this story and to an open letter written by Tara Monaghan from Salins, County Kildare, to the Taoiseach. The 24-year-old schoolteacher who emigrated to London in 2012 tells Enda Kenny, "I'm coming home for Christmas, but I want to come home for good." Elsewhere this morning, The Independent also has a piece which provides the paper's other editorial this morning on some of the ghost estates which have been spared the wrecking ball due to the economic upturn. The Times has a piece on Irish company Greencore, which has been accused of exploiting UK staff in a row over low wages and poor conditions. Chief Executive Patrick Coveney earns €2.5 million a year. Elton John's wedding ceremony is the showbiz story of the day. Pictures were uploaded on Instagram throughout the day yesterday by the newlyweds and their celebrity guests, and you'll find lots of them carried in today's papers. The Examiner has a story today about an extensive rescue operation undertaken over the weekend following the partial collapse of an historic weir at Ballincollig Regional Park, which saved 10,000 fish. The Times, meanwhile, has a piece about a beekeeping project in the northwest inner city in Dublin, which is to be set up in the new year and will feature a number of bait hives and will train local people up as beekeepers. The HSE is thought to have spent €2,500 on a Christmas tree outside University Hospital in Dooradoyle in Limerick, which has been described as a waste of money by Clare councillor Anne Norton. The Times, meanwhile, has a front page picture of the bells of Christchurch in Dublin being prepared for the extensive use they'll be getting over the coming days. But finally, the Examiner carries another Christmas story today about a group of lifelong friends who attracted lots of attention when they did the 12 pubs of Christmas night out dressed in chocolate bar suits from the Cadbury selection box. The lads also uploaded a picture of themselves lying on the ground covered in a net, which so far has been liked 350,000 times on Facebook.
And we're returning now to Irish Water, specifically the figures obtained by our reporter Colman O'Sullivan, which showed that the company's investment on infrastructure has been significantly lower than the average amount spent by the state during previous years. This is despite assurances that the company's establishment would herald a substantial rise in repairs to the country's ramshackle water infrastructure. Documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act also show that Irish Water has not fixed any more leaks this year than were fixed by local authorities back in 2013. With us is Michael McNicholas. He's Chief Executive of Ervia, Irish Water's parent company. Good morning.
Morning, Rachel.
Can we look first of all at this overall figure? Up until November, Irish Water's capital spend on infrastructure was €300 million, but the annual spend by the state over the previous decade was about €430 million. So why the fall?
Well, first of all, the figures that you put out this morning are not new. They're the figures that we announced in May of this year. And we're on target to spend €340 million on capital investment in Irish Water this year. That's the highest figure in the last 3 years. In 2015, we are targeting to spend a minimum of €410 million. And based on the figures I've available on a like-for-like basis, that is higher than the average of the last 10 years. And we want to ramp that further up to a spending on an annual basis of €600 million per annum. This is the minimum that we need, in our view, to fix our ageing infrastructure.
So why then is the figure so low this year?
Well, it's higher than the last 3 years, first of all.
Yeah, but last year was a special case, as Colman O'Sullivan was saying earlier. The state was getting ready to hand over Irish Water, getting ready to hand over the whole job to Irish Water. So it seemed that many things that might have gone ahead were put in abeyance for a year.
Well, let's be clear, it's higher than the figure in 2012 as well. So it's the highest figure in the last 3 years, and it is ramping up. So as a new utility, we're only started up. When you're spending money on capital infrastructure, it takes time to get the planning permission, to do the designs, to go out for specifications, and to get the most efficient and cost-effective prices. What we've done in 2013 is increased the spending on water infrastructure, the highest in the last 3 years. And in 2015, as we ramp up further, we'll increase it to 410 at a minimum.
Yeah, but you can look at figures in any way. If we go back to, say, 2009, the spend was €512 million.
Well, I agree, Rachel. You can look at figures in any way and make any story you want. The bottom line is that in 1 year we may have spent almost €500 million, but what we have not done in this country is consistently spend the level of capital that's needed on an annual basis every year. And we haven't done that because when it's subject to government spending, it's subject to the priorities of government on a year-by-year basis. By setting up a new utility, a single utility, with a sole focus on fixing our water infrastructure, we can be absolutely sure that we will spend the money that's needed. And because Irish Water is a utility, we can access the capital markets. And that gives us the facility to raise money in the capital markets to ramp up that spending to €600 million a year.
Well,
that has never been done in the history of the state.
The suspicion will be that you would have had more money to spend this year if less was spent on setup charges like consultants.
Well, and that is if you're going to set up a utility, you have to invest in putting that utility in place. In 2013, we spent of the order of €100 million on putting together all of the systems and processes that are needed for a new utility. We spent that money by using systems engineers, system designers, software engineers to build the utility systems that are needed. So the money that was spent on building infrastructure and assets for a new company that will serve this country for the next 40 years. And that investment has already been shown to be in line with best industry practice. And in my own view, and I'm in utilities for over 30 years, the programme that was put in place by Bord Gáis in 2013 to build the utility is better than I have ever seen in my experience before and meets or beats best international practice.
Okay, can we look then at these figures in another way? Other documents obtained by Colman show that the number of water leaks being fixed will probably be in and around the same number as last year. Why no increase?
Well, there are two things. Our focus in 2014 was to do two things. One, gather the data that we need to understand exactly what's going on with our infrastructure. And two, we shifted some of our spending away from fixing leaks, particularly in the worst pipes, because all you do is fix the leak, all it does is causes a leak somewhere else because the pipework is rotting. So what we've done is instead of continuing to fix the pipes, we've replaced the pipes. And the data we've gathered is allowing us put together a structured programme, because we didn't arrive at this position in 1 year. We've arrived at this position because of decades of underinvestment. And frankly, it will take decades to fix it.
But frankly, then, there has been no improvement this
year.
Yes,
there has, because we've improved it, because what we've done is we've spent more money on replacing pipework than just fixing leaks. And what we will do in 2015 and 2016 is we will go into a structured programme with three key elements. Number one, we'll invest in pressure reduction, because that stops forcing the water out through our ageing infrastructure. Two, we will replace the worst of our rotting pipework. And three, we will accelerate the find and fix programme. So we are going to go into a structured national programme so that we will ensure that we invest the money on a priority basis and get the best return
on
that investment.
So 12 months on from now, will you be able to say to us that the company has fixed more leaks?
We will have either fixed more leaks or replaced more of the rotting pipes, whichever makes more sense in terms of reducing the amount of water that we're losing. It's not just about fixing leaks, it's about reducing the amount of water that is being lost.
And do you know that you have reduced that water?
Well, in 1 year, it's very hard to say, because what we've actually found is the situation is worse than people believed. And the metering programme has helped us do that. We have been astounded by the fact that over 13% of the water that arrives at our homes in Ireland is being lost through leakage. And the metering programme has shown us that. And more importantly, and I must say for me, who has been in the industry, as I say, for over 30 years, the metering programme is going to substantially pay for itself through what we've found in terms of the information that is giving us a loan, which is a phenomenal finding.
And yet you don't know the percentage of the country's water supply now being lost through leaks?
We don't, because we're only gathering the data, and what we're finding is it's worse. We now believe that where it was believed as an industry standard over the last 5 or 7 years that we were losing something of the order of 40-45% leakage, we believe, unfortunately, that's now closer to 50%. So in our first year of operation, as we get our hands around what is the most complex and greatest transformation ever in the history of this state, we are finding that the situation that we've inherited is worse than we believed it was.
But you don't have the figures to say that you've made things any better.
We know that we have fixed as much in leaks as we ever fixed before. We know that we've changed the priority of that investment to replace pipes that are rotting, which is a much better use of that investment. And therefore, we know that at least things have not deteriorated in terms of the money that's been spent. But we have, unfortunately, discovered that the situation in terms of the infrastructure on the ground is worse than we believed it was, which is why it is so urgent and necessary to have a single focused utility repairing that situation.
So why then didn't you have an accurate picture before now? I mean, was somebody lying to you?
Well, let's be clear, we couldn't have an accurate picture because we didn't exist. All we can do is take the information.
But you say that you started off with figures, so they presumably were given to you by somebody. Presumably they were given to you either by the Department of the Environment or by the local authorities.
And what we've done since then is install over 500,000 metres, which tells us information that no one was aware of, that it is worse than we thought it was, because we're losing 13% of the water that comes to people's homes through leakage. And I think you used the figure this morning. Can you believe that 77 homes in Dublin are using 1 million litres of water a day, not a year, as was reported, a day? That's 500 times the average household usage. The metering programme is helping us identify that. And the reason the situation is worse is because we have more data than we had when we took the situation over from the local authorities. It is not, as you are suggesting, potentially, that people weren't telling us what was going on. It is that our metering programme is delivering real value, and we're discovering new information.
Okay,
that
so
tells
you,
us
you
what's
have
happening.
More information now. Can we
Lots
go back
more.
To a story which featured on RTE's This Week programme yesterday? Your company, known as Bord Gáis at the time, queried the need to install meters as a prerequisite for charging water users. Why did the company do that?
I think when you look at the scale of the programme we're talking about here, which is a huge transformation, it's natural that people would discuss the priorities and what comes first. There was never a suggestion that we would question whether meters should be installed. It was just the timing of it.
So you didn't think it should be a priority?
No, we didn't say that we didn't think it should be a priority. As would be normal when you're looking at a programme, you have to look at all of the things that have been done, all of the money that has to be spent, and you ask questions as to where we start, because when you look at the scale of it, it's sometimes very hard to know where to start. All we were doing was I wasn't in the company at the time, but the best information I could gather is that we were looking at what the options were, but at no time were we questioning whether meters should be installed. And what we have discovered by installing those meters is significant.
You've made that point. Why are there no notes or minutes available for more than half of the meetings that took place between Bord Gáis and the Department of the Environment during Irish Water's setup phase? That's odd, isn't it?
Well, to be honest, I can't comment on that. I wasn't at those meetings. I've just joined the company since 2013, and I can't tell you what information was.
Does
or
it
wasn't.
Strike you as odd, though?
I'm not sure if it's actually the case, because I haven't heard that until you just raised it with me.
Well,
now, so
it was reported yesterday on the This Week programme, and I think many people listening at the time would have said, hold on a minute, are these things not supposed to be kept? Are there not supposed to be minutes of these
meetings?
And as
I said, I can't tell you that they weren't. And I would say I'd be surprised if there aren't accurate information available for anything that we would have done. In fact, I'm sure there is, but I can't comment on that because, as I say, I'm not aware of it and I wasn't at any of those meetings.
Well, certainly that's what our reporter John Burke was told, that for half of the 23 meetings that took place between Bord Gáis and the department during that setup phase in 2012, that there were no minutes available.
And as I said, I can't make comment because I wasn't at those meetings.
Michael McNicholas, thank you indeed for joining us on the probe.
People are waiting for hospital tests. According to the Sunday Business Post, there are hidden waiting lists of tens of thousands of people waiting, in some cases over a year, for scans for cancer and other conditions. Over 27,000 people for MRI scans, according to a parliamentary response given to Fianna Fáil health spokesperson Billy Kelleher, and that these are not included in published waiting lists. The Minister for Health says waiting times for public patients are unacceptable, but there is no attempt to conceal the information. The latest HSE figures in October show that around 381,000 people are waiting for an outpatient appointment and around 53,000 people are waiting for an inpatient appointment. Angela Fitzgerald, the HSE's National Director for Acute Hospitals, is in our studio. Angela Fitzgerald, thank you very much for coming in to us. The figures that I've just quoted, which are from the HSE's performance review for October, are they accurate?
They are accurate. The figures you've provided, just for our listeners, show us the numbers of people waiting for an elective procedure, whether that's a day case or inpatient, and you've talked about the 50,000 figure there. The figure of 381,000 is every patient who's waiting for an outpatient procedure, an outpatient appointment rather. Just to put that into context, we see 3 million people a year in our outpatients. So the 380,000 is about 10% or 11% of that group. Within that, there is about now, there are 14% of the patients, total patients, waiting over the 12-month target.
That's over 50,000 people.
This time last year, that was over 100,000. So the improvement programme that was put in place allowed us to deliver a sustained improvement. That's the first time that we've done that. And I think one of the things we're trying to do now is to learn from what works. So we know in relation to outpatient, what works is having good data that's reliable and that's measured consistently across hospitals. We know that you actually have to have agreed referral criteria so that doctors who are putting a tag on a patient of being urgent, that that's consistent. We know that validating the waiting list, and I heard you mention that earlier, just to explain to the listeners what that means. What that simply means is that the patient is still needs the treatment and is still available for the treatment. What we have found when we validated an outpatient waiting list, that people were on, as Dr. Duffy said, multiple waiting lists, and so therefore in many cases they'd had their treatment and yet they were still represented on our waiting list.
Yeah, now just I know this is going back over old ground to some extent, but one of the ways that you validated those lists was to write to the patient to ask them do they still want the procedure. That's hardly a useful or an accurate way of validating
At the same time, we would always write to the treating, the referrer. In the case of an inpatient procedure, that would be the consultant. In the case of an outpatient procedure, that with the GP. No patient is ever removed from a waiting list without the agreement of the consultant or the GP.
The people who are on inpatient waiting lists, over 53,000 people, what are they waiting for? Does that include people who are waiting for procedures like MRI scans, for
example? It doesn't.
Why
and
not?
Just to explain, the procedure for an MRI is at the early point. As Trevor said, it's at the first point in the chain of having a patient treated. So to determine whether an inpatient procedure is indicated, a patient needs a scan. So going back to the suggestion that we're not publishing those or that we're somehow hiding waiting lists, if you look at the HSE website, there's a huge amount of information provided, and every month on the performance report, we're very direct and clear about where we're not delivering. And
yes,
I think
but
you
apart
have
from
that information.
Apart from endoscopies, done for a gastrointestinal test. I can't see any other diagnostic
tests.
No,
we haven't included the diagnostics. And just to explain what we've done, similarly what we did with the outpatients, up to about 2 years ago, we weren't reporting in the public domain on outpatient waiting lists. We did a huge exercise of trying to make sure that when we put information out, that we can stand over that information and that it's reliable and it's consistent and that it is representative of where the status is. We're adopting the same approach in relation to the diagnostics. And just to explain to people who are listening, anybody who's waiting for an urgent diagnostic for a cancer treatment, the wait time is 7 days, and we're satisfied that in the main that time frame is met. If there's anyone out there this morning who has a concern, whether that's a GP or whether it's an individual, they need to contact us immediately through their hospital. In terms of the average wait time, over 90% of people are waiting within the timeframes we've agreed. You mentioned MRI. MRI is a particular challenge, but if you look at CT and ultrasound, there's no one waiting over 12 months. Coming back to MRI, it is our most expensive treatment, as Trevor said earlier on. And what we have done in the last 12 months, thanks to the whole kind of HRA and public sector agreements, we now have an extended working day for radiographers. What we want to try and do is align that with the other people involved in it. So the HRA programme has allowed us now to run additional sessions over the day. But Trevor is quite right. He mentioned that in the private sector, people are running 16, 18 hours a day. We're resource constrained in terms of doing that. The other experience we've had from the outpatient is about using what you have more effectively. And if you look at the hospitals that were named yesterday in the media, some of those have done very innovative things. So, for example, Beaumont and the Mater have tackled the long waiters, and they're now in a position to reduce the wait times.
Half past eight, I'll get to news headlines in just a moment. From listening to what you're saying, from looking at the numbers, from listening to what Trevor Duffy told us earlier on, if you're sick, or more to the point, if you're worried that you're sick, isn't the moral here that you're better off going private?
I don't agree. I think if you
find... But you'd be seen quicker.
I think if you can see if you're sick, you see that we're seeing those patients immediately. What we have found is there is a role for the private sector.
The point of being referred on to an expert is you don't know how sick you are until the tests are done.
Well, I think the first point is that's why referral criteria are very important, and that's why we're working with the GPs to make sure that if a patient has an urgent tag, and I've said already that those patients are seen within 7 days. We have used the private sector and it has a role to play, but we have found in relation to outpatients, it is very difficult for the patient to navigate their way back in. So I think where the private sector has worked in collaboration with the public system is around the inpatient side. I think at the outpatient side, it is important that they're seen in the public system.
Okay.
And we have a plan in relation to, it's published in our operational plan for this year in terms of tackling diagnostics, and we're happy to provide that information to you at any time.
When will you have a list published?
We will have a list published in the first quarter of this year.
Angela Fitzgerald from the HSE, thank you very much for coming into our studio. Pádraic Lodge is back at more sports news. Morning again, Pádraic.
Good morning, Gavin. Well, golfer Rory McIlroy was named as the RTE Sports Person of the Year. He received his award at a ceremony which was run in association with the Irish Sports Council at the RTE television studios last night. McIlroy won two majors and was also part of the victorious Europe Ryder Cup team. He told Greg Allen about his joy at receiving the award for a second time.
It means an awful lot. To win the award again is something that's a huge honour, and it's always nice to be recognised for your achievements, and obviously this year, 2014, it's a year I'm immensely proud of, and as I said, it's just nice to be recognised for all the hard work that you put in, and delighted to pick up the award again.
Rory, so many people marvel at your talent, but you mentioned the word work there. How much work has gone in to turn what was not a great year for most of 2013 into the brilliant, extraordinary year that was 2014?
Yeah, a lot of hard work. I feel this year I just got back to what I do best and how I work best, especially on off weeks. Working better with Michael Bannon, working better with Steve McGregor, just preparing better for tournaments, and that's really been helpful. I think that's been a huge part of why 2014 has been so successful.
Finally, 2015, how optimistic are you that it's going to be a good year?
I'm very optimistic it's going to be a good year. I feel, as I said, I feel like I've found that formula that works for me, and it's just about making sure that I continue to do that, and I see no reason why 2015 can't be just as good, or if not better, than 2014.
That's Rory McIlroy. The Irish rugby head coach Joe Schmidt was named manager of the year, having led Ireland to third in the world rankings with victory in the Six Nations Championship and in all three November internationals. Well, after a public vote, the Team of the Year award went to the Cork ladies footballers, who won their ninth All-Ireland title in 10 years with victory over Dublin. Breege Corkery captained the team this year.
We're just absolutely over the moon. When we heard it, we just got such a shock. And even about maybe 5 or 10 minutes after, I think we were trembling with just such overwhelming night and everything. So we're just so delighted.
And when we look around the wall at the people that were nominated alongside you for sports person, and then you look at the teams and, the lads winning the Six Nations and the, Kerry, Kilkenny, all that's been done this year, to be head and shoulders above them in the eyes of the public, it says an awful lot about the hard work you've done.
I suppose, you know, we've done hard work over the last maybe 9, 10 years, and maybe we haven't gotten as much recognition as we probably should have. But I just think, you know, this year, just I suppose the way we won the final 17 minutes to go and 10 points down, we really, I think we just showed the public that, you know, we are a great team, and we're just hard workers and we love playing football.
What is the key to the success that you've had as a unit?
I suppose Eamon often says us to behave like nuns. So
do you?
We try our best. You know, I suppose that's the thing about it. He never has to tell us. He only tells us once or twice a year, and the girls just do it themselves. Small heads and small arses. That's our big motto.
The inimitable Breach Corkery there. That's a motto that a lot of us could adopt, I think.
One for the next couple of weeks, at any rate.
Reach Corker there was chatting to Damien O'Mara, while Brian O'Driscoll was inducted into the Hall of Fame. His parents, Geraldine and Frank, were on hand to make the presentation. They eventually got around to playing the Tipperary County football final yesterday, and it produced the result that nobody wanted, a draw. Lochmore Castellini 2-7, Kerr 1-10. The replay will take place on St Stephen's Day in Cashel with a 1 o'clock throw-in. The dramatic headline on the score.ie website says Christmas is cancelled in Tipperary as the last county senior final of 2014 ends in a draw. While there's a photograph of the Kerr goalkeeper Brian Enright slumped to his knees on the ground after the final whistle above the caption, Brian Enright realises his plans for Christmas are in ruins. Now, John Fogart in the Irish Examiner points out that by the time the replay arrives, it'll be 239 days since the championship began in early May, and the Lochmore Castellini manager Declan Laffin has indicated that his team will be training on Christmas morning. So it is not a lot of Christmas spirit for the players in Tipperary. Liverpool manager Brendan Rodgers has said his side can finish in the Premier League top four after their battling 2-2 draw against Arsenal. Martin Skrtel, playing with a head wound, headed an equaliser 7 minutes into injury time at Anfield. Liverpool are now 10th in the table, 9 points behind 4th-placed West Ham. And this was Rodgers' assessment of his team's display.
We're disappointed with the goals that we conceded. Decision-making was not as we would want, but overriding emotion is that, for me, we're on the right track back to where we've been for a couple of years, and now we just need to keep this work rate, the quality and the character going.
Philippe Coutinho opened the scoring for Liverpool, while Matthew Debussy and Olivier Giroud were on the score sheet for Arsenal. Elsewhere, Adam Johnson's late goal gave Sunderland a 1-0 win over Newcastle at St James's Park. The leaders Chelsea can restore their 3-point advantage over Manchester City with a win away to Stoke City tonight. In the Scottish Premiership, Celtic lost 2-1 at Dundee United, while Ali McCoist has left his position as Rangers manager. The club say that he's now on gardening leave. Here at home, Bray Wanderers have called a news conference for this evening to announce details about the future of the club. Darren Clark finished tied 15th in the Dubai Open. He posted a level par 72 in the final round to end on 9-7 shots behind the winner Arjun Atwal from India. There was a double for Willie Mullins and his son Patrick at Thurles yesterday, including a very impressive winner of the bumper, Pile on the Pressure, while in show jumping, Wexford's Bertram Allen placed 7th in the World Cup qualifier at Olympia in London.
This weekend, the number of people who've died on the roads during 2014 surpassed the number who died during all of 2013. With us is Moya Murdoch, Chief Executive of the Road Safety Authority. We had seen several years of improvement, and now over the past couple of years, that has changed. Do you know why?
First of all, Rachel, let me just offer my sympathies to the families of the two most recent fatalities, as you've mentioned. Another bad weekend for vulnerable road users, with a 55-year-old motorcyclist and a 15-year-old passenger in a car, both losing their lives. Yes, as you point out, it's been very worrying for road safety this year. 2014 sees a continuation of the increase in the number of fatalities on the back of 2013, after 7 years of a decline. This follows 7 years of improvements in both all categories of road users, in particular drivers. What's very interesting this year is actually the number of drivers who have lost their lives is actually down on 2012, our best year ever for road fatalities. It was 77 so far this year compared to 78 in 2012. So what is of particular concern is that while the driver deaths are down, driver behaviour towards other road users has not improved. We see an increase in all areas of the vulnerable road users.
So pedestrians, people on bicycles and the like.
Motorcyclists, yes, where we would class them as our more vulnerable road users. They have all increased. We have seen to 140% increase in the number of cyclists, a significant increase in the number of pedestrians as well. So it is an area we have seen a slight improvement in motorcyclists, but not enough to give comfort.
Could this be partly explained by the fact that there are many more cyclists on the road than there were a few years ago?
Absolutely. Cycling has become much more popular. But I think there's a number of observations that we probably can make at this point. We have had two fine summers of good weather, good months of June, July, August.
More people out walking people the highways out, and byways.
Being healthy, cycling, young children out playing in parks and in estates. And what is of concern is that the increase in that activity has led to a decrease in driver observations, and really they have been the victims of some careless driving and poor driver behaviour.
Talking about driver behaviour and careless driving, you're particularly worried about the use of smartphones. You say smartphones are the new drink driving.
Yes, it would appear that definitely our figures from observational studies show an increase in the number of people admitting to using mobile phones, and the number of detections that we are getting from the guards in terms of intercepts for people using mobile phones. That's up 16% this year. Benchmarking ourselves against other jurisdictions, we see in the States that could be up as high as 20%, where there's probably more mobile phone use and smartphone usage. So it is a very worrying trend, and something that we need to tackle now before it becomes an epidemic. So that is something that both ourselves in the Road Safety Authority and the guards are concentrating on. Like drink driving, the role of the Road Safety Authority is to change attitudes and behaviour. And we've seen that happen in terms of drink driving. So we need to see the same sea change in the attitude towards using a mobile phone while driving.
Moya Murdoch, thank you for joining us on the programme.
Hundreds of thousands of people are coming home to their families for Christmas. Many will pass through airports all over the country this week. Cian McCormack is at Dublin Airport this morning. Cian, is it busy?
Oh, it's really, really busy at the moment, Gavin. Many flights arriving this morning, transatlantic flights. I'm in Terminal 2, and we'll hear the stories of the people coming in them in a few minutes. Other airports like Shannon, Cork and Knock are busy too. Shannon will have 51,000 passengers between now and the new year, marking its biggest number since 2009. Cork Airport is expecting around 100,000 passengers up until January 4th, and Ireland West Airport at Knock will have 30,000 people coming in and out on flights, and that's the airport's busiest ever Christmas, up 5% they're saying when compared to last year. Well, joining me now at Terminal 2 is Siobhan O'Donnell from Dublin Airport Authority. Siobhan, very busy here in Dublin, lots of people using it as a gateway to come home this Christmas. So what's your advice to people coming to the airport?
Well, we'd advise people to check which flight their flight's departing from, which terminal their flight's departing from, or if they're picking up people to check. So as a general rule, Aer Lingus, Etihad, Emirates and all the American flights come into T2, and all the other airlines operate from T1.
How many people are you expecting in and out of the airport?
Well, we take 2 weeks from last Friday until the 2nd of January, and we have almost 800,000 passengers arriving and departing, and that's 8% up. So that's quite significant.
I have to say, you're standing here and very briefly in a Rudolph jumper with Christmas lights on it. You look like a Christmas tree. What's happening here at the airport today?
Well, today we're having our DAA charity Christmas jumper day, and I'm the chairperson of the charity. I want to lead by example. So we're going to have all our staff, as many staff as possible, hopefully our frontline staff, to make the place extra festive and Christmas cheerful today.
Siobhan O'Donnell, thank you for joining us this morning. Well, we've heard about the numbers of passengers coming through the airport, so now let's hear the voices. I was talking to people coming home for Christmas and their families earlier on.
Sharon O'Farrell, and I've just travelled from New York. Home to see my mommy. It's good, but it's tough coming home and then having to go back again, so it's a bit of a roller coaster ride. At least I'm lucky I can come home.
Margaret O'Farrell, I'm Sharon's mother. I've been so looking forward to her coming home. It's like, it's so far away, you know.
It's special for Christmas as
well. Oh, completely, because Christmas, in my experience of having spent two Christmases in New York, it's one day, and then where I live, they're throwing the Christmas trees out into the trash the next day. So, yeah, it's a big deal here.
Of course, lots of Irish people in the States who can't come home because they've taken the choice to be there illegally.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there are. And I know quite a few, actually. Yes, I was only speaking to some of them last night, and they're just devastated. But that's the choice, the tough choice that they had to make.
My name's Connor. I'm from Dublin, but coming home from New York.
I'm Claire, his sister.
And Catherine, his mum.
And why are you over in New York?
I live there now, so I've been working over there as an architect for the last few months. And yeah, it's all going well, but always good to come home.
Delighted to have him home. It's great.
Will you keep him at home?
Yes.
Do you want to stay at home?
I do. In front of them, I have to say yes.
You are an architect, so over the past number of years, there wouldn't have been a lot of work, really.
No, yeah, there wouldn't have been. I mean, it's definitely picked up in Dublin over the last year or two, I think. But you set down roots somewhere and you kind of want to stay on for a bit longer. And
what are your perceptions from abroad of Ireland?
Mostly positive. People see it in a very good light.
Do you think there would be much work for someone like yourself over the next couple of years? I think you're kind of set on staying in New York for the time being.
For now, yeah. I mean, definitely if you're graduating from architecture in Dublin, I think there's much more jobs than when I came out about, 2011, which was the height of the crash. But no, I think now if you came out, you've definitely got a chance of getting a job here. You don't have to move away.
What are the plans then for Christmas Day, Claire?
So we're going to our cousin's house for Christmas Day, and then I'm getting married on the 30th, so there's loads of celebrations.
Glenn Messina from New York.
Nice family scenes here.
Yes, very nice family scene. Wife's home, seeing all her family.
And what's her name?
Sharon.
Everyone's here to meet you. Lots of excitement.
Oh my God, it's wonderful. We needed to be here this year.
Is this your mum here?
That's my mum.
Marta, how are you doing? Sharon's home.
Oh, we're home. All home, thank God, yeah.
I'm delighted, absolutely thrilled. Couldn't wait to see them all.
In front of them, I have to say, yes, passengers arriving home at Dublin Airport this morning. Cian, 2 weeks ago you reported from Tipperary on how the parish of Gortnahoe Glengool in the county is getting 18 young players back home from abroad this Christmas. And some of those players will be coming through Dublin Airport, and there's something special organised.
Oh, that's right, Gavin. The club, as you were saying, they've organised that home to hurl for St. Stephen's Day. And that will mean, I think the figure is actually now up to 19 because an extra player is coming home. Well, they'll have that match where those 19 players will take on the Gortnahoe Glengool Parish team. But the president of the GAA, Liam O'Neill, is backing up the initiative. He's here at the airport because tomorrow he'll be arriving in here to welcome one of the last hurlers from Gortnahoe Glengool into the airport. And also as well, a busload from the parish will be coming up here at about 11 o'clock tomorrow. But Connect Ireland, the initiative to try to get immigrants abroad to connect and bring business back to Ireland in terms of jobs, they're involved with an initiative with the GAA. What's this all about, Liam O'Neill?
Well, Connect Ireland is about communities, about bringing jobs to communities in Ireland. It's about people who are working in companies abroad, giving their connections to Connect Ireland, and in the hope that if their company is going to come to Europe, that Connect Ireland can entice them to Ireland. That'll mean jobs for local communities. That's very important to us because we want our players playing abroad to get back home, and we'd love to be the conduit through which that information can flow from abroad to Connect Ireland.
And there's that GAA network abroad. Of course, that's the flip side of having so many young people travelling to different parts of the world. It means GAA clubs are stronger in faraway places.
Absolutely, and the Department of Foreign Affairs are delighted to back this as well, and we're delighted that GAA is on board with this. We can actually, through this initiative, be more relevant to the GAA community by connecting with people abroad, because we actually are providing a service around the world now. When a person goes abroad, they're connected with our GAA clubs abroad, and they don't have to be GAA players. The GAA clubs are quite willing to help out anybody who goes abroad, and we would love to be the means by which jobs could be brought back to Ireland so our players could be brought home. We have the Sam Maguire and Liam McCarthy Cup here to greet people. People are having their photographs taken with it. They're dropping their connections to the Connect Ireland people, and we've had a fantastic reaction to it, and we're really pleased with the initiative. Over 1,000 people have signed up so far. We're here since the 15th till tomorrow, and we hope that as many people as possible will give their contacts to Connect Ireland.
Well, briefly, the Home to Hurl, we have a lot of players coming home. That's a great initiative, isn't it? Do you think these 19 players will stay home in Ireland? Unlikely, I'd say.
Well, it's a probably unlikely initiative, but the initiative is fantastic. We're delighted that Keith Dwyer, Mark Dwyer and Augie Longer are here with us. And we hope that this might give the inspiration to other clubs to do this, bring as many people as possible home, and hopefully some of them will get jobs here through Connect Ireland and will stay with us.
Well, you mentioned the three guys here. I think you're all cousins, or you're all first cousins in some way, but Keith Dwyer, Mark Dwyer, Augie Long, you're home now. You're after travelling from Melbourne. I must say, when I look at the Gert na hUa Glen Gould jersey, I always think of the Cork jersey, but far away from that in Tipperary.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. It's going to be a great day for the community. Charities for Scoile Angus and North Tip Hospice. We're going to bring home 20 guys to play a game of hurling. It's going to be a great day for everyone.
It's going up. It's 20 now. Mark, it must be great to be home, is it? What do your parents think?
Yeah, no, it's always nice to be home, isn't it? I mean, don't get me wrong, like, it's nice to have the nice weather over where we are, but home will always be home, and you know, I'm just delighted to be back to see everyone again, you know.
Well, you're back from Perth, and finally, I think you're after arriving from Reading this morning, Uggy. That's right, is it?
From Birmingham.
From Birmingham, is it?
Yeah,
happy to be home then?
Yeah. Looking forward to meeting all the boys that have been away for so long. Like, I haven't, my first cousins, I haven't seen them for about a year and a half, I'd say.
It's both. All part of the Home to Hurl initiative. But out of all of the guys, we've gone from 18, 19, now 20. But do you think many of you will stay at home? Are the jobs there in mid Tipperary for you?
Not at the moment. I don't think so yet. But hopefully, through the Connect Ireland and the connections thing that might develop, and through this, we can spread the word.
Keith Dwyer, Mark Dwyer, Augie Long, enjoy the game on St. Stephen's Day. Best of luck with that. Liam O'Neill, President of the GAA, thank you for joining us too here at Dublin Airport this morning. It's going to be busy here today, but for now, it's back to you in studio.
New drones flying into homes all across the country on Christmas morning, but the Irish Aviation Authority is reminding people that users of these unmanned devices must obey the rules of the air. We're going to have a quick word with Donal Handley, who's head of corporate affairs at the Irish Aviation Authority. In my innocence, I wasn't aware that these things were so popular, but what are your concerns?
Good morning, Rachel. Well, the first thing I'd probably say is, you know, safety is our business. Safety is our number one priority. And drones, model aircraft, or what we actually call them, RPAS, remotely piloted aircraft systems. Essentially, there's been a significant growth in this area in the last couple of years. And what we're trying to do is communicate to the general public that there are rules of the air that they must abide by. So what you have is, you actually have a drone is an aircraft which is being manned by a pilot on the ground. And we're a little bit concerned that people probably don't realise that they actually have to abide by these rules of the air. Just like if I go out, I have to abide by the rules of the road. So to give you an example, if you're operating your drone from your back garden, you need to be cognizant that you can't actually operate any further than that. You have to, once you're in a built-up area, a populated area, you're in breach of the regulations. You can't operate them in at night time. You can't operate them near an airport or an aerodrome. In a flight path, you have to maintain visual line of sight and so on. So what we're concerned about is that people probably, you know, in their innocence, don't realise that they actually are in breach of the regulations if they operate them in a built-up or a populated area or near an airport. And we're trying to avoid an accident on the ground where, you know, somebody might lose control, it falls from the sky, there's a malfunction, and it causes an accident. And again, we're trying to avoid an accident in the air where it gets ingested by an aircraft engine in the vicinity of an aerodrome. So these are the type of things that, like, you know, we want people to enjoy them, we want them to operate them, but we want them to operate them in a safe and a responsible manner and to obey the rules.
Just briefly, Donal, if you would, if somebody wants to look at these rules, because like I was saying, I gather there may be quite a few of these things in stockings on Christmas morning, where can they see the rules?
Well, what you need to do is go to our website, go to iaa.ie/ORPAS. Read up on it. Get familiar with the rules. There's a lot of information there. And you might even want to go a little bit further. You might consider doing some sort of an approved training course in the use of drones and the use of ORPAS. And there's a number of flight training schools out there where you can educate yourself. Because we'd strongly encourage people to be responsible. Think about it. It's not just a simple toy. It is something that could cause an accident. And with the best will in the world, we're hoping to try and avoid that.
All right, Donal. Thank you very much indeed for that. A minute to nine.